Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. We like to educate here on the podcast, but is there such a thing as too much information? We're about to find out as we welcome the author of new book, Eat, Poop, Die. The author in question is Joe Roman, a biologist fascinated with the natural processes that go on within animal biology and which also shape the natural world around us. Speaking to Joe for this episode is molecular biologist and science communicator Dr. Ganesh Taylor, who's a postdoctoral research scientist at the Francis Crick Institute. Let's join Joe Roman speaking to Ganesh Taylor now.
Today, I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Joe Roman. Joe Roman is a conservation biologist, marine ecologist, and editor of eattheinvaders.org. He's winner of the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award for Listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act. Roman has written for the New York Times, for Science, Slate, and many other publications. He's a fellow and writer in residence at the Gund Institute for Environment at the University of Vermont. And we're here today to discuss his latest book, Eat, Poop, and Die: How Animals Make Our World, with its very iconic cover, very catchy. So, hi, Joe. Welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Hi, Ganesh.
My first question is, how on earth did you get an editor to agree to publish a book about just the worst things in life, surely?
Oh, that's a good question. A few years ago, I was on a Fulbright in Iceland and was putting together a talk for the final talk after a year of work, and got up early in the morning, put a slide together, and I said, for the past decade, what I've been looking at is how animals eat, what happens when they poop, and what happens when they die, and surely that should be the title of my next book. It took a couple of years to find the agent to want to pitch this. And we held our breath whether the editors were going to stick to the title, but they did. So, it was cheeky, but we got lucky.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question because actually, exactly as you say, I mean, that is what you talk about in the book. And you did a fantastic job of getting me as someone who is definitely not into any of those things, particularly I wouldn't consider myself to be interested per se, to actually look at these processes with completely different eyes. So I think that people are going to find the book really fascinating. And what I'd like for us to talk about today with our audience, basically, or to persuade them of that effectively, is about how the way both human beings and other animals eat, the way they poop because they've eaten, and how they die actually seems to really shape the world around us. These are very underappreciated forces, as you say yourself in the book. So before we dive into the fun parts, being a scientist, I feel compelled to ask you to start with what I understood to be the central point of this, these sort of different mechanisms, which is basically it all comes down to nitrogen and phosphorus. Am I right? Is that what you're basically saying?
That's right. There are essential nutrients, and anyone that's grown a garden knows this, right? You know that there are certain elements are essential to life on Earth. Nitrogen, phosphorus are two of the macro elements, and then iron is another one that I talk about in the book. Without that, we wouldn't have DNA, we wouldn't have reproduction, we couldn't form muscle mass, so we really couldn't function at all, either as animals or plants. So we've long understood that plants are the lungs of the planet, let's say, right? They're taking carbon dioxide, emitting oxygen, and allowing life on Earth as we know it. What I think has long been overlooked is the other elements that are essential to life and how they move around. Because, of course, plants, they grow in place. I'm looking out the window, I'm seeing a forest, but they can't move. What animals do is they allow these elements to move through the system. I think of whales as a good example. They dive deep down in the oceans, they come up to the surface to breathe, and when they poop, they release this nitrogen. That's really the essential core of this idea for me is how animals can move these nutrients and why it matters, how we can build ecosystems through these processes.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. I mean, you start the book with this very compelling example of basically how this new island that emerges out of volcanic lava gets turned from a hot rock in the ocean into something that has life on it via bird poop, basically. So tell us a little bit about that. How was that experience?
Yeah, it's amazing. So November 1963, there was a fishing boat off the southeast coast of Iceland. They smelt some sulfur, and the engineer looked around, the boat was fine, and then they noticed they were in a bit of a whirlpool, and all of a sudden there was this eruption column that went up, and within a few hours, that eruption column was reaching a mile or two in the sky, and within a few years, a brand new island was formed with no life on it at all, of course, right? So all you've got is this hot lava that's cooling down. Scientists really at that point didn't know how life was gonna colonize on this area, how long it would take, how it would get there. A few plants came in from the ocean. What maritime plants can survive on these islands because they can float on the ocean and carry a lot of nutrients with them, right? They've got the nitrogen in there. Anything that's blowing in has to travel light. It's not going to survive. So what happened in the 1970s and 1980s is dozens to hundreds of seabirds, including gulls, kittiwakes, and other species, started nesting on this island. A good safe place for them, no predators, it's a chill place, right? And they're feeding from the ocean. So they're going back and forth to feed themselves and also to feed their chicks as they're forming those nests. And dropping about 100 grams of poop per day. And in these areas, it's about 30 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. That's comparable to what a farmer might put on a permanent grassland, right? So a lot of nutrients are going in there every year. And all of a sudden, you're getting these grasslands starting to form. And it looks like a meadow there. The difference is 50 times more biomass where the seabirds are and where they're pooping compared to the black lava where they're not feeding and they're not found. Why this story is so compelling is, as one of my colleagues said, ecology isn't rocket science. It's a lot harder. Everything is so complex. Here, the scientists had actually been following the individual plants, the individual birds, and be watching year to year, and they've studied it now for 60 years. It was just the island's 60th birthday. And by the way, some of the researchers are older than the island, so it's kind of cool to be on an island with people that have been around longer than that. So this really was a natural laboratory that Iceland has protected. 2 weeks a year, only scientists are allowed to go. I was lucky to go in 2021. And join the biologists for a week there and become an embedded writer or scientist, helping them count the birds or looking at soil samples and getting to look in the intertidal. It was fascinating.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, I'm a laboratory-based scientist, but I think a lot of people forget that a huge amount of science is done literally out in the field or lava field in this context, I guess. I mean, this was another theme, actually, now that we've raised it within the book. So, of course, there's lots of facts and stories about how these different kinds of animal movements and migrations and the circulation, I think was the word you used several times, shape our environments. And we'll get back to that, I'm sure. But another theme that really struck me was that you you do actually make a point of talking about the scientists and the science of it and the people who are interested in studying this, people like yourself and your colleagues, right? And how our knowledge has grown and changed with time. I think that's a really important thing to make people aware of, that this is not just a static like subject, right? We've learned new things. So I guess, is that also part of why you felt compelled to write this book, perhaps, about, not to put words in your mouth, but yeah, is it the changes of the knowledge and in the fields, in your field? You're nodding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so no one knew what was going to happen on Circe. They had been studying it, you know, and then in the 1980s when they started to seeing these changes. And really this idea, there's a new term for it. One of the people I meet in the book, Oz Schmitz, they use the term zoogeochemistry. It's like biogeochemistry, but what the animals do, right? So how do animals affect the world? This is a brand new term. And this whole, people have been thinking about it mostly through seabirds. Guano has been known, and there were some studies done in the early 20th century looking at that seabirds might actually enhance the amount of fish in an area because they're bringing nitrogen in. But beyond that, there were very few studies really until the 1990s and 2000s. This is when people really started to focus on animals. I think that's partly because a lot of effort, understandably, goes into studying microbiological processes as well as plants around us. We can see that. We can see the impacts. Animals are moving, and we're not necessarily seeing that circulatory system in action. And that's how I think of it, right? That's because they're hard to see, but also because wild mammals right now, they're only 4% of all biomass on the planet. So it's not surprising that we don't think animals that are important, because if you look around you, it's cows, it's sheep, it's other humans. We've really altered that. When we learn about these systems, often the most exciting discoveries, sea otters are an example, are when species are restored and all of a sudden you see the ecosystems change. We have Circe as an example. Another example would be sea otters that were reintroduced to parts of Alaska in the 1960s and 1970s. No one knew what was going to happen. But now their kelp forests have returned, the nurseries for fish have changed, the feeding habits of bald eagles, all because this one animal was restored to that area. So we have a lot of these individual examples where animals are changing it over time. Then we're also looking at these long-term impacts. So you could think of migratory salmon or the work that I do on migratory whales as another way. But I think getting back to your question, it's not about facts. It's about learning new things. I'm not in this field to memorize facts. And I tell my students that, right? You know, you need to have some basic understanding. But what's cool is over the years, I'm telling a different story from what I told 10 or 15 years ago as our understanding of these processes get better.
Yeah. I mean, that actual fact that you also share in the book, that wildlife on planet Earth is only 4% of our biomass, that human beings make up 36%, and the remaining 60% is animals for human consumption effectively, really blew my mind.
Yeah, I had to read, when I first read that paper, I was really the same. I didn't believe it. I'm like, but does this include whales? Does this include this? And so we're talking about mammals, just to be clear, not all wildlife, right? This is for mammals. It's also true for birds, but it's 70-30 for wild birds. So about 70% of birds on the planet are chickens and turkeys. Of course, we've changed the way the world works if we've removed all those large animals. And, you know, we've been talking about seabirds, but I'm sitting here in North America. We can think of, there used to be 30 million bison migrating across the continent, and they were reduced to a few hundred. And now there may be a couple of thousand, but they don't do those migratory patterns anymore. of course the prairies are different, and you know, and the ecosystems are different now that we've taken these, what one term uses, ecosystem engineers out of the system.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by this. Like, one of the themes that really came out of the book, for me at least, was this idea that human beings and their eating habits and their demands have shaped the world. And sometimes it seems to have been the case that it's a bit unknowing. So guano being this term for bird poop, basically, I did not know that it was a really critical fertilizer and was, you know, underpinning the growing agricultural shifts within our societies, and that people were literally shipping bird poop across the planet to be able to grow the crops necessary for the livestock to feed the human beings, you know, that were around at the time. And that then, you know, suddenly this biomass that's produced by animals becomes a rate limiting factor, right? Like, there's only so much poop you can get. And then when that happens, human beings do this thing, right, where they push against those limits, and they'll push the system to its limits. And then, you know, things like artificial fertilizers get developed, right? And that, you know, in the book, you talk a lot about how, especially in the latter, sort of later parts, about how the generation of artificial fertilizer has really disrupted the system that was kind of already imbalanced by the effects of human beings. Is that a fair summary, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we've just spoken about what happens if you take the animals out of the system, and then also where you're shipping this the guano around the world, and that makes, really allows Australia to become a wealthy country based on the guano, because all of a sudden you could have all these this vast grasslands. So it changes the fate of a lot of countries around the world. It was in the beginning a renewable resource, but we overexploited it, so we didn't have enough to continue. In the 20th century, there's a development of this process, the Haber-Bosch process, which allows us to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and to create ammonium, which can be used for fertilizers. If we make a muscle right now, half of the nitrogen in my body is coming from artificial processes. You know, when we're just eat, if you eat a regular diet and you eat out of the supermarket, it's certainly a lot of it is coming from artificial, you know, something that's been artificially developed, which has allowed human populations to increase around the world. But also, as these things do, it comes at a cost. That would be true for phosphorus or nitrogen, in that we have now areas that are, you have way too much nitrogen in the system. So it could be affecting rivers or oceans and changing the way those systems are. Ideally, we want it to be a balance that's dynamic, but not one where you're continually adding these. And one of the other problems with the Haber-Bosch is that it's very energetically very expensive. So you need a lot of petroleum in order to put this process through. So it can have an effect also on global warming, as well as on nitrogen presence around the world.
So all these things are so interrelated. I didn't realize that. So this Haber-Bosch artificial system also requires oil in that case, eh?
Yeah, it's energetically expensive. Again, it has been valuable, but unfortunately, we've also misused it. And so, one dream is to think, and we've had problems with both phosphorus as well as nitrogen. Can animals help restore the natural movement of these elements around the world, and what would that look like? So that's one of the things we think about. Is one of the phosphorus is certainly unlike nitrogen, we cannot create phosphorus. There's no artificial way. We have to mine it. So can animals help move the phosphorus and the nitrogen around, which would reduce areas where there are hot spots, there's too much of these, and help it disperse it onto fields or into forests or to areas around there. So we've been proposing that as one approach, is to use animals as a facilitator for moving these nutrients around the world and maintaining that kind of balance.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there seems to be in general a bit of a shift to taking a slightly more sort of, let's say, holistic view of ourselves, right, within the context of our planet. And I can see that theme coming through very clearly in what you're saying, and also obviously the book. This idea that, us as human beings and our eating habits having had a detrimental effect on all of these other organisms and the way they move and the way that they are able to do what they're doing is ultimately starting to feed back to us, and we're starting to pay the price for that, right? And so now we have to shift this balance a little bit and thinking a bit more creatively about how we might, rather than having to engineer our own direct solutions, perhaps it's just a matter of letting animals do what they do best, right? There's a line where you say, something about basically opening the gates and letting animals just do what they do naturally. I think that I was really struck by a lot of the little examples that you gave of things that I think people don't realize come from animals, like beaches, in Hawaii coming from fish poop. I don't know how many people know that, right? what else would you, I'm trying to think of any other examples. What would your fun fact be of something that most people wouldn't appreciate comes from an animal but does? I think that's a pretty good one.
I think that, here's the thing. If you've been to a tropical beach, they're often surrounded by corals, right? And the source for the sands that you're sitting in are ultimately those corals, but they don't break up into small pieces. What happens is parrotfish, which can be 100 kilograms, they can be quite large, they continually are biting on the dead corals, getting some of the algae that grows on it. And then you can see it if you follow these around. It almost looks like a freight train. You see the sand coming out of their gills, and they're also pooping it out. I study whale poop, and I can spend days on the water and not see one. There, it's like, a couple of times a minute you're seeing them poop that out. And in some places, as you had mentioned, there's 80% of the sand that you're sitting on has actually been defecated by parrotfish. This is so important that it could be one way for low-lying nations to mitigate climate change, because that's how much sand these fish put out when they're abundant, in that it might be able to keep up with sea level rise. So they can be an essential, yeah, it's really amazing. It can be an essential form of climate adaptation, is restoring these. And to bring us back, one way that one is not directly harvesting these parrotfish, which are essential to so many island systems, but the other is when the seabirds are there, they're bringing more nutrients in. That makes for larger parrotfish because the corals are thriving, and that makes for more sand. So by restoring the whole ecosystem, you can have many benefits for people as well as for wildlife.
I think the other one of the other examples that you brought up in the book was, you know, so sea turtles have these annual migrations to reproduce, and then they make their eggs in the sand. And somehow this leads to basically from egg loss and the nest production, you end up with better dunes. And dunes are really important for mitigating against sea level rises. That also like blew my mind a little bit, this idea that, you know, we tell ourselves these stories about human beings being environmental engineers because, you know, we do, fair enough. And it somehow implies that animals just don't, that they're sort of just pottering along, you know, doing what they're doing in the environment. But you really made a case for the fact that like animal behaviors really actively shape the environments that they're in.
It does. And I mean, one way we framed it is, you know, are they passengers or are they driving these ecosystems? And the truth is some animals are having a big impact and others are having a little impact and, you know, and somewhere in between. But those animals, like the sea turtles, a great classic study because they spend their entire adult lives at sea feeding and then they come up to nest and they're releasing eggs and yolk and the eggs that die. And that's that, as you had mentioned, it has a big impact on the dune system in that area. That's a great early classic study of this kind of work, is when you see animals moving between two different habitats and what kind of impact that can have, that can also benefit the turtles as well as the dunes.
So I'm mindful of time, and we've talked a lot about eating and pooping. These are things that, you know, viscerally, I guess we're all very aware of. We all know that we eat, we poop. Other animals do that. If you have a pet or a child, you know, you see and experience those things a lot. And it's not a huge leap to think about how organisms, you know, might be doing that out there in the wild and, you know, to think about the effects they might have. I think the most challenging category of your book was the die part, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, death is one person's or one organism's death is another organism's eat and poop start of their cycle was something I guess I've never really thought about quite so viscerally. So you said yourself you study lots of whale poop things and you talk a lot about the whale falls. So, I mean, talk to us about that, about the sort of giving back moment.
Yeah, I mean, so this is another one where you talk about how long have people known this, that the first whale fall, which is one term we use for a whale carcass when it sinks into the deep sea. First times humans saw that was in the 1990s, not that long ago. And when they first looked at that, okay, dead whale, no surprise, they died deep at sea. But then they saw all these living creatures on the whale carcass, which was surprising because only 100 years ago, people thought there wasn't much life in the deep sea. Now, we don't have large trees in the ocean, but we have large animals. In fact, the largest animals that have ever lived, think of a blue whale. When that whale dies, it's this huge habitat that's created. It's like an island in the deep sea because the deep sea doesn't have a lot of nutrients. In one pulse, about 1,000 years worth of carbon that would just fall out in particles lands there in a single dead whale. And over the past couple of decades, 100 species have been described that are only found on whale falls, unique to that habitat. They're endemic to this area. And some that are really quite bizarre. For example, osedox is a type of worm. It means bone eater. Unlike most of the animals I talk about in the book, it doesn't have a mouth, it doesn't have a gut, and it doesn't have an anus. So it doesn't eat or poop. But what it does, it has like a root system in the whale bones, and it's taking up sulfides and nitrogen and other elements and providing it to chemosynthetic bacteria that are in its trophosome, or what used to be its gut. And they're producing the amino acids and the sugars for the worm that lives there. These animals are absolutely dependent on these bones. So one of the sad things is, because we killed so many whales in the 19th century before that, we think that probably some of the earliest extinctions in the ocean might have been in these deep sea communities that we didn't even know existed at that point. So because we're taking the habitats out, right? When you remove the habitat, of course, you're more likely to have extinction. The good news is we have more whales now than we did in the 1970s because of good conservation efforts. So now we believe that some of these species could be coming back, and they form entire communities that persist for decades.
I mean, actually, this reminds me, you talked a bit in the book, and in fact, about how it used to be the case that many cultures across the world, very, very diverse and different cultures, all have methods for basically disposing of poop and carcasses in a way that involves, bizarrely, actually putting back. Like, if you look back, you know, with current knowledge, you might think, hey, that makes sense. And I'm curious as to whether you think that, do you think that people were aware of that? You know, you talk about different tribes putting bones back into the ocean, or burying guts of things that they've eaten in forests, and that being really critical. Do you think they knew, or do you think this is just something that makes sense from other reasons?
Yeah, I certainly think culturally the traditions, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, of returning salmon carcasses to the streams, because we haven't spoken about salmon, but they spend most of their life offshore, and then they come to breed and they die. They breed once and they die, and that can be an enormous resource, not only for humans, but also for nutrients in that area. So my understanding is that those cultures would have understood that. But certainly, I mean, we've had terms like night soil, which describes human feces. I mean, just the description alone indicates that they knew what it was, right? You know, that this could be an important form of fertilizer that comes from humans. So we could think about it. One is thinking about what we're going to do with the carcasses. And for sure, even in England, you weren't allowed to disturb either carcasses or defecation because they were important on those pastures. The farmers knew it at that point. So I think, you know, we moved away from it, understandably, when we moved to cities, because you can't just have carcasses and feces and urine all around. It doesn't work, right? So you've had to have different ways of processing it. Now we're thinking about ways, how can we get back into that cycle? And for the book, you know, I went up to a local place called the Rich Earth Institute and got a pea cycler and saved my pea and put it out, you know, in the fields near here, trying in the same way for us to be part, to restore our place in the environment. When we live in cities, it's going to involve different processes, you know, but this container-based movement can be really important. Keeping animals in place. We talked about whale falls. Often when whales strand, we put them back in the ocean or we bury them. But by leaving them on that coastline, if it's not in an area like a beach where lots of people are using, can feed hundreds of different animals. So restoring that system, we will learn a ton. And again, 50 years ago, a lot of the things we're talking about today, people didn't really know. So who knows what we're going to learn in the next decade or two as we allow these pathways to become restored.
The final sort of thoughts in the book that came to me, at least when I was reading it, was about this idea that basically we live in a culture these days, at least in Western Europe and in the States, of if something's broken, you just get a new one. And that's not something that we can do with the environment. And this idea of like fixing or you know, seeing to and tending and fixing basically things has gone very much out of vogue, but it's kind of the only option available to us with the environment, I think, was what I got from what you were saying, at least, which kind of links up in my head with what we were just talking about, you know, past cultures you know, maybe doing some of these kinds of behaviors that naturally were more a bit more in balance with what was going on. So I'm starting to get this sense of almost like a revisitation of previous ways of looking and maybe considering the world around us and our position within it, and then sort of hooking up our modern knowledge with that to sort of more mindfully allow that kind of healing maybe process to occur. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Just in the course, during the time of my career as a conservation biologist, we didn't really have the term traditional ecological knowledge. That is learning from the people that have lived in these areas. It makes sense, but the idea that people, and this would be true for animals as well, that have been in these systems for hundreds, thousands of years, obviously have some good, deep knowledge to the system. So employing that, being humble in, like you say, not buying new or figuring out some hard structure way of fixing things, but some way of restoring these nutrient pathways. And that could be through people, right? Through adapting in different ways, but also restoring, rewilding. And we mentioned a little bit sea otters, but I'm looking out the window here in Vermont, and there's an effort to restore mountain lions to this area. They've been extinguished for over 100 years. What would that do? It would change the behavior of the herbivores, the white-tailed deer here, and a lot of things that we might, challenges in this area could be addressed by restoring carnivores. So it's one term we use is trophic rewilding. The idea that by the animals that are eating other animals are helping to either restore, in some cases it'll be restore, in other ways it'll be creating new pathways. But essentially, I think it's staying humble and curious is what's going to get us a lot further than trying to, as you would say, you know, it's broken, let's buy something new, let's figure out some new technological advance.
That's fantastic. I've had the most fantastically fascinating conversation. Eat, Poop, Die, How Animals Make Our World is actually now available in your local bookstore. I am Ganesh Taylor. You've been listening to, or possibly even watching, Intelligence Squared. Thank you so much, Joe Roman, for joining us, for writing this book, and for making the time to talk to us a little bit about the thoughts and findings that have driven you to writing this fascinating piece.
Thank you, Ganesh, and it was a lovely chatting with you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up, and members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.